BCFM 93.2.
There's a method to their madness. There's really not much method to yours, because you're operating from a place of ignorance. And until you change that, you're going to be bumbling around, bumping into each other, saying and doing the wrong things, not understanding the nature of your enemy. And if you don't understand the nature of your enemy and the weapons they use, you cannot fight that enemy. You can't fight the battle. You shouldn't even be on the battlefield. That's why you're losing the war. And don't tell me you're not, because I'm in a place of great knowledge about who's winning and who's losing this war. And I can assure you, you're losing the war. Doesn't mean it can't be turned around. But it'll never be turned around until you learn what you need to know.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. By the 18th century, Bristol was at the centre of the slave trade. Now, where did we get that idea, that bright idea from? Also this week, Prime Minister Theresa May stopped Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee from interviewing 19 of the 23 intelligence officers and staff involved with torture. The remaining four were not allowed to talk about any specifics of their operations, nor to fill in any gaps in operational timelines. So who's in charge? Security services or the government? And the up-and-coming NATO summit, why is Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg bricking it? The investigation into US military flying in cocaine from Colombia, one of the original authors, reviews last year's feature film about Barry Seal, the cocaine pilot. The film's called American Made. And hypno-programming for assassination. Is it really possible? Local journalist Tim Tate explains how it may have been used to kill US presidential candidate, or he was in the running anyway, Robert Kennedy, back in 1968. Plus, in our series looking at the Israel lobby, the former head of studies at the US Army War College, Alan Sobroski, charts the rise of the US-Israel lobby, that is the Anti-Defamation League and the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, from virtually nothing back in the 1970s up till today. And as I also said at the top of the hour there, the slave trade, Liverpool, Bristol and London pioneered the horrific triangular trade, which led to the deaths of millions. Their bodies were just simply thrown overboard the slave ships. But where did we get this business model from? We hear about the important part the Italians played. First the Roman Empire and then the merchants of Venice. Our sister show Dialects back on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. You can catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, a US freelance journalist who used to work for the TV networks, Daniel Hopsicker, he talks about uncovering the lies around the flight training of the 9/11 hijacker Mohammed Atta and his friends. Also, his most recent investigation into Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska and the international mafia's love of election fixing, that is, Russiagate. Then we also hear from local writer and filmmaker Tim Tate on his latest book about the Robert Kennedy assassination, the second of the Kennedy brothers to be murdered by the US deep state, or the Nazi faction, whichever you prefer. So we'll be hearing clips from both of those in a minute. That's Dialect at BCFM noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now. But Martin, I mean, this week, obviously, we've got to start with this torture investigation, which doesn't seem as if much investigation was actually allowed by the Prime Minister of the Secret Services.
No, I mean, the MPs will have only heard the very tip of the iceberg for the reasons you've just explained. Even so, they've taken a fairly strong stance that it shouldn't have been happening. And Theresa May has even said, oh, yes, this shouldn't have been happening. And, of course, it shouldn't have been happening, but it has, and it's been happening on a massive scale.
That's easy to say, isn't it? Anyone can say it shouldn't be happening, but then it carries on happening, and nothing is done to punish those who allowed it to happen.
No, they're not. I mean, frankly, Western intelligence services, including our own, are way out of control. They are not answerable to the political leadership, but the political leadership isn't the elected political leadership, and there's a complex deep state in Britain, as there is in the United States of America and elsewhere.
Do you have any truck with those that say that actually we do need to torture people to get information out of them? It's the only way?
Nope. I've got no truck with that whatsoever. We also have a rule of law. If people break the law, if they're terrorists or whatever, then they need to be prosecuted. And justice has to be done and seen to be done. I mean, in actual fact, torture in judicial trials was banned in the Middle Ages, under Magna Carta. And that was felt that it was inappropriate then, never mind now. And the idea that somehow the specious arguments that torture may be helpful in some way or other is ridiculous. What should happen, of course, is the people in Britain who set up the death camps in Kenya in the 1950s, in which up to 250,000 people were tortured to death with electrocutions, hot water, whippings and so on. They should be put on trial now. They're probably still alive, some of them, because people need to face the truth. And the truth is that the deep state in Britain, in Ireland, in Kenya, in Palestine, and today in Iraq, Afghanistan and other places, is way out of control, and many of the people in it should be prosecuted, put on trial and sent to prison. And of course, if it's in the US, some of them should probably be executed, because that's what the law says.
Now, Fintan O'Toole in the Irish Times this week published an article, trial runs for fascism are in full flow. He says, babies in cages were no mistake by Trump, but test marketing for barbarism. He says, to grasp what is going on in the world right now, we need to reflect on two things. One is that we are in a phase of trial runs. The other is that what is being trialed is fascism, a word that should be used carefully, but not shirked when it is so clearly on the horizon. He says, forget post-fascist, what we are living in is pre-fascism.
Well, I mean, that's a strong statement, but it's not inaccurate. But you've got to imagine, I mean, people who listen to this show regularly will know that in actual fact, as far as I'm concerned, the deep state carried out the 9/11 attack. They killed 3,500 people so they could then set off to kill millions more. And they're way out of control. And in many respects, that's the turning point of the 20th century, of the 21st century, as 1939 and 1914 were of the 20th century. And we're going to have to resist this stuff and create a rule of law in Britain and elsewhere around the world, or we will fail, and there will be a barbaric denouement onto all of
this. What Fintan O'Toole is saying is that actually there is a popular side to this, that actually by doing things like torture, by doing things like separating kids from their parents, there is some sort of dark side to human nature that these policies play to.
Indeed, and in actual fact, this is what we're being acclimatized to, the idea that, you know, war is normal. It's about 1984, isn't it? War is peace, ignorance is strength, and all the rest of it. And we're pretty close to that. I mean, the consumer masses in the West who just worry about where they're going on holiday this year are actually complicit in a global system of appalling ferocity and viciousness. And, you know, of course, a lot of the so-called terrorist attacks against ordinary people are nothing of the sort. They're orchestrated from inside the deep state. But if there was an orchestrated, you have to say to people, for example, in this country, the people who thought it was a good idea to invade Iraq, but they don't want any Iraqi refugees. You said it was going to be easy, it was going to be a pushover, Saddam Hussein would go and it'd all be fine. You all thought it was brilliant. It wasn't brilliant. It turned into a disaster. It's been a total disaster for the people of Iraq, and lots of them are turning up. And do you know, if I was the French or the Germans who didn't go into Iraq, I'd say, you can have them, Britain, because you said you wanted the war. I'm afraid the world is full of payback. Just is.
Things
it's the way the world
things
works.
Are getting nasty in the cabinet. Apparently, Gavin Williamson, the Defence Secretary, is threatening to bring Theresa May's government down unless the Prime Minister commits an extra £20 billion to defence. This is just after the visit of Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General. He says, Williamson says, I made her and I can break her.
Well, I can imagine what she's thinking about him at this moment. But the fact is, him pushing... I mean, there's no money for anything. The Labour Party sums just don't add up, blah, 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 blah. I'll put another $20 billion for our friends in the defence industry, where all of these ex-generals get their retirement.
That money is not for the defence industry, it's for the armed forces, sure.
Yeah, but the armed forces, you'll see that all these ex-generals who sit on the board of BAA Systems are the ones who are lobbying that we need all this kit, because we've got to deter the Russians, etc., etc., of all of which is orchestrated from within the deep state. The Russians have no intention of fighting with us unless we fight with them. And, of course, we are pumping all of this up so that these ex-generals can be... like General Danet, for example, who's a great cheerleader for Israel. Now he's no longer running the British Armed Forces. I've got no time for these people, frankly. We do need armed forces, but we don't need these people running them. They should all be put out to grass. In fact, as I've said earlier, some of them should be prosecuted for war crimes and sent to prison.
MI5 and MI6, Martin, are alleged. And, I mean, this is one of the things that amazes me about the coverage of this Intelligence and Security Committee torture report this week, is that actually one of the most horrendous things that MI6 have done is, and Roland Dumas exposed this, that was in 2009 when David Miliband was the Foreign Secretary. He was invited over to Britain to a private meeting where it was discussed that they were going to start arming the Syrian opposition and start an armed uprising. Now, that has led to absolute carnage. I mean, do you think there's any real evidence that MI6 are totally responsible for what's happened in Syria?
They're not totally responsible, but they were the lead agency on behalf of the CIA. So Britain often takes a lead role. We took a lead role in the overthrow of Gaddafi, for example, and we took a lead role in the 1980s with Operation Cyclone for supporting the Jihadi International Brigade in Afghanistan, which were all funded by our taxes and trained by our military personnel. And then suddenly, oh my goodness, they've blown up the Twin Towers. Oh no, they didn't blow up the Twin Towers, they flew planes into them, sorry. And there was a third tower.
They blew up Bosnia in the meantime.
Yeah, well, exactly. Basically, British intelligence services and military have had their finger in all of these post-imperial pies for years. We're about to open a new naval base in Bahrain, which is the first time...
Well, this is all foreign stuff, but what about domestic terror attacks? Because I was looking last weekend at some messages that I got in communication with one of the eyewitnesses at the Manchester Arena attack, and that her name is Dawn Waddy. She, you may remember, is the person that spoke to Sky News to say that there was a suspicious woman next to her who didn't seem interested in the concert, was fiddling with her bag, kept looking round to where the bomb eventually went off, and she and her daughter both reported this person to security. The security turned round to them and said, well, how would you like it if someone pointed you out to security and said you looked suspicious? And they did absolutely nothing. They didn't check her bag, for example. And of course, the rest is history. So Dawn told me that she'd reported the seat number of this person to the police, given them all this information, and has heard absolutely nothing from them, nothing from victim support either.
Well, the father of the alleged bomber, before he was dragged away in Libya to be presumably executed, I would imagine he's no longer still alive, he said, well, I worked for the Islamic Fighting Group, because the boy was also part of the Islamic Fighting Group, all of which is based in Manchester, has been based in Manchester since the 1980s.
He'd be an interesting person to interview.
Yes, he would be, wouldn't he? That's why he's been disappeared, Tony, so we can't find out what happened with him. And in actual fact, MI6 have been intimately involved with Sunni jihadi terrorism from the 1980s onwards, and in fact, prior to that. And then we're supposed to believe that these Sunni extremist networks, which we armed, trained and created, have suddenly, we've lost control of them, and now we've got to we need loads more money to try and catch all these terrible people that we put in business in the first place. Why is the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group based in Manchester? That would be an obvious question to ask. But of course, we've got a lone bomber, supposedly.
Well, he wasn't
dead.
Alone. Hang on, Martin.
No, he wasn't alone.
Somebody made his bomb for him.
Well,
indeed.
And therefore, the whole thing about the Manchester case stinks to high heaven, because there's clearly some kind of infrastructure behind it.
Was it the person who was sitting next to Dawn Waddy?
Well, no.
She
doesn't sound to me like she's the bomber, but she's somebody who knows something about it, and the police should have interviewed her. The idea that this guy built his bomb on his own and then blew himself up
on
his
own
just doesn't hold water, does it?
About Dawn, Martin, is the fact that she was attacked literally by internet trolls for weeks and months after the attack. And, you know, this sort of thing, the intimidation of eyewitnesses, many actually have not been interviewed over the years and neglected or frozen out. But there are quite a few things to do with these terror attacks where, for example, with Manchester, it has echoes with the 7/7 London bombings. I'll just run through a few of them. Helplines, for example, inoperative and give no useful info. Well, we had the same at Manchester. Vodafone have a contract with the Home Office to do these helplines and nothing happened. They have apologised to the inquiry to say that their helpline software was faulty and wasn't working. And so it took many, many hours for that helpline to actually be put into place. We had a similar thing with 7/7 where there was over a week for some of the families of the victim to be informed. They were even desperately going around London putting pictures of their loved ones on lampposts because they were getting no communications from the people they should have done, the police, etc. Also, a false alarm of a second terrorist, giving the police and private security total control of the terror attack crime scene. Well, that happened at Manchester. There was absolutely no... The police didn't allow the fire brigade to come in, for example, for 2 hours because they believed there was another terrorist. That same thing happened at the Westminster attack. Everyone was told there's a second terrorist. And this does give the police and the private security complete control of the crime scene, Martin. Also, Northern Rail employees were told by the police at Manchester to leave the area whilst they were trying to save the lives of injured people, and they refused to go.
Well, regular listeners to this show will know that my basic understanding of what goes on is that jihadi terrorism in particular is actually 99% orchestrated from in the Western intelligence service. So that's certainly what the Russian general staff believe, and they're not stupid people. And they're not necessarily our enemies either, despite what some people say. And the fact is that a lot of what's been going on is incredibly suspicious, and the police ought to be independent of the intelligence services and the military, and they ought to be holding them to account. That doesn't happen because they're the junior partners, and the reality is that we are a very scary reality. Jihadi terrorists are being groomed and orchestrated
like
by our own security
services. Like Manchester have,
to scare the pants out of
have anti-terrorist specific squads, and so the ordinary police have to get out of the way and make
well that's what that's what happened in Salisbury with the Skripal case. The Wiltshire police were taken off it straight away and it was handed over to Met Anti-Terrorist Branch, who are also part of the security state infrastructure.
Okay, no CCTV footage of the suspects at the scene. Oh dear, that Manchester too.
That also happened, that's extraordinary, isn't it? You'd have thought an arena like that would have loads of CCTV, but apparently none
at
all.
We were actually shown a piece of CCTV footage or some stills of Salman Abedi, but all of the entire background had been blacked out, so you couldn't tell. He could have been in Australia, and they're saying, "Oh no, this is him in the arena," and we've blacked out the rest of it. But you've got to trust us.
Yeah.
This is
the fact is that when things like that, the Westminster attack, right? Do you remember the Westminster attack? Where we were told that there was no CCTV footage of the attack because of spending cuts by Westminster City Council, the CCTV wasn't switched on. I don't believe that, Tony. I think that's a fairy tale. And when you find the authorities coming out with fairy tales like this about very serious incidents where clearly lives have been lost, then the question has to be, is this orchestrated by the deep state? And that's not a stupid question. It's an absolutely straightforward question. People in Northern Ireland know exactly what I'm talking about.
In all these terror attacks last year, Westminster, the London Bridge and Manchester, the suspects were reported to the terror hotline. Obviously, were well known to the security services. It didn't seem that there was any particularly close eye being kept on them, and they were able to go on and commit a terrorist attacks.
Well, what the whole infrastructure is created by the deep state. Sometimes what's happened in the US, the FBI has basically arrested loads of people who were supposedly terrorists, and basically the FBI entrapped them. They found people who were vulnerable. They said, hey, why don't you want to blow something up? Psst, psst, psst. Then they give them something to blow, and then they entrap them. And juries in the US, to their great discredit, have been convicting these people on the basis of basically FBI entrapment.
Do you remember
but of course,
a young
sometimes
girl,
the FBI
Martin?
Allow it to go ahead. They don't stop it all.
Do you remember a young girl called Khadija Sultana? She was the Bethnal Green school kid who was
she went to Turkey,
she was recruited by Canadian intelligence on Facebook online, pretending to be jihadis. They got her over, persuaded her to get to come over on a plane with two of her friends over to Istanbul. And then this guy met her at Istanbul airport. He went on a bus with her and her friends down to the south of Turkey and handed her over to British intelligence, who then took her on to become a sex slave for ISIS. So, I mean, this is
That was uncovered by Turkish police investigation, and then the police officers, the Turkish police officers, were then accused of treason and imprisoned.
So if our intelligence services and the Canadian intelligence, etc., can take our own school kids from East London and feed them down to ISIS with no consequences, is it any surprise that we've had such a cover-up over this torture report?
Well, I mean, let's cut to the chase here. It's pretty clear that Western intelligence services, including MI5 and MI6, are the terrorists. Now, what do we do about that? I suggest that we fight for a rule of law. We fight for a police service. Maybe the police service of Northern Ireland, which has been reformed, need to be brought in to bust some people and feel their collars. Now, that's the decent democratic way to do it. But ultimately, of course, it's going to have to be settled in a different kind of way if they're going to carry on with this kind of behaviour. And I'm afraid it's become ingrained. They've been doing it for years. They think they can get away with it. They do get away with it. But at some point, the intelligence of the ordinary population is going to rise to a level where they're simply not going to accept this nonsense anymore. Now, and of course, every incident allows us to look again at the way they lie and the way they manipulate.
And the way they avoid any even basic scrutiny by MPs. So one wonders who they're working for. They're clearly not working for us, these intelligence officers. Arkady Babchenko, the fake Ukrainian killer, has been detailing his plot to the BBC. Mm. The only trouble is that it looks like he was working very, very closely within intelligence services. There's no evidence given of any government, Russian government involvement. All the key participants appear to be Ukrainian. Even the alleged chief plotter states he was all along working with the Ukrainian spy agency. So what was this about, this fake death a few weeks ago?
I mean, obviously we're only
the BBC seem to be going along with it. They're just giving them the entire platform.
And that just shows how completely corrupted they've become by this kind of ideology of psychological warfare, as it were, against Russia and other, you know, enemies of the state, as it were. Well, it's just indicative. I think it looks to me like an operation run by the Ukrainian SBU without full consultation with their Western allies, the CIA, MI6, and so on.
That's why we haven't heard any more about this. Because all of the evidence has just crumbled as soon as anyone starts to look at it.
That's right. And, of course, more to the point, of course, is the shootings in the Maidan Square, which began the whole crisis. There's been a court case in Kiev, and sometimes the things do go to court, where the Berkut riot police have been exonerated. They didn't shoot the protesters. People from Georgia have testified on Skype that they shot the protesters. There were 50 of us. We're all Georgians. We're mercenaries. We're employed by the new regime and their Western allies to kill the pro-EU demonstrators and police officers. And there's been a court case where that evidence has been accepted as the truth. Why isn't that on the BBC?
Well, one thing that was on the BBC, although not looked into very deeply, is a fascinating story. I think it must be story of the week this week. It's the cement company under investigation for allegedly funding a terrorist group. The allegations relate to events that took place before Lafarge merged with Holcim in 2015. Cement maker Lafarge was charged this week by French prosecutors over allegations it funded armed militant groups in Syria to keep a plant there open between 2011 and 2014. The company, which was formed out of a merger, said it had been placed under investigation by magistrates in Paris. The allegation relates to individual wrongdoings which occurred in the former Syrian operations of Lafarge Cement Syria. This company was basically dealing with the company as if it was just the legitimate government of Syria, Martin. One of the reasons I find this particularly fascinating is that Etienne Davignon, who was the chairman of Bilderberg, was also the chairman of the Lafarge company.
Yes, I mean, obviously I've only just heard about this today, so the detail's not clear. But the idea that Western powers and their allies, you know, cement companies and so on, are working with jihadi terrorists, and then, of course, turning around and telling the general population, oh, these terrible jihadi terrorists, you must give us more resources to fight them. That's the game. You know, they set the foxes up running, and then they shout tally-ho and chase after
them.
Well,
what's happening here
is they're wrecking everybody's crops.
What is happening here is the company was making payments to Islamic State in order to ensure its plant continued to run while the war went on. Now, is that acceptable?
Well, it's pretty normal practice in most countries where that sort of thing goes on. I mean, if Islamic State control the area where your company is, if you don't pay them off, then you're out of business. But it's more than that. I think that's the tip of the iceberg. The fact is that Islamic State came out of nowhere, and it was only able to survive because it had outside support. That's why the Russians bombed all of those convoys of tankers which were taking oil from the Syrian Syrian oil fields into Turkey, which were then sold on the international market illegally.
On geopolitics this week, we've heard actually some quite nice news about ceasefire going on this weekend in east of Ukraine, and also what with the North Korea also seemed to be calming down. Maybe we're heading for a great era over the next few months, at least, of world peace, Martin.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, Tony, because there's too many other things that could go
wrong.
Well,
like Yemen, for example, no. And the reason, of course, that the Yemen war is happening is to stop the people in Yemen on the Arabian Peninsula actually toppling the rather fragile Saudi royal family.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Yemen is a proper state with a proper population. Saudi Arabia is just essentially a Ponzi scheme run by one family backed by the Western intelligence services. I think there's no reason for optimism, really, even in the Ukraine and in Korea. All that will happen, at best, is the conflicts will be frozen. They won't be resolved. They're not going to. The major problems we face as a human species are not going to be resolved until the ruling class in the West has been comprehensively defeated.
And what do you,
I'm afraid
that's the only way. What's
the
prospects in Israel Palestine? Because it's not looking good there, particularly, is it?
It's not looking good from a Palestinian point of view, but I would point out to the Israelis that if you end up triggering World War III, your state's only been there 70 years, and the same with the Saudi state. It's only been there 70 years. The Russian state's been there for 1,000 years. We've been here for 1,000 years. You're not going to, you know, who's going to be left standing at the end of it all?
What about the sanctity of things like the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock? These are the two big Islamic... they're not temples, are they? Mosques on the site of the third temple in Jerusalem, which a lot of the far right in Israel, they just want to demolish these mosques, but they are supposed to be sacred and only for Muslims.
Well, I mean, this kind of religious aspect of the conflict is particularly intractable, although it's quite straightforward, really. The Muslims should just be allowed to have their mosque.
But
some people don't want that to happen, Israelis, therefore the possibility of conflict about this exists.
Some Israelis have been violating that.
Yes, they have.
Haven't they?
Hardly any
reporting. It's kind of niggling away at this. Yep. At these basic, every single agreement between Jews and Muslims, it seems.
Yeah, I mean,
we're
reaching a point from the Palestinian point of view. They've got to decide what they want to do. But if they decided to declare war on Israel, they'd be perfectly within their rights to do so. They wouldn't win. It would be one-sided, but they're entitled
to
do it.
They would just end up being massacred, wouldn't they?
Well, it depends. It depends how the Syrian war plays out. Because if the Syrian army is able to get up to the Golan Heights and Russia and Iran are pushed into a corner by the West, then it could be that the Russian army will sort out the Israelis for the Palestinians.
Well, we've got Jens Stoltenberg and the NATO summit coming up in a few weeks' time, but he is bricking it, isn't he? The reason he is because of Turkey.
Well, it's not the only reason. He's also bricking it because Trump is going to meet with Putin against the wishes of it. I mean, the Americans have been telling everybody for years and years and years, don't talk to Putin, don't have anything to do with him, blah, 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 but we're going to talk to him. It's like, well, hang on a minute, we've told our populations that we're not to talk to him at all, and we're not allowed to talk to him, but you're going to talk to him. Yeah, because we're the Americans, we can do what we like. If we want to talk to him, we'll talk to him. You're not allowed to, but we can.
Okay, so we're going to have a listen now, as I said at the top of the hour, to a local investigative journalist who used to work for Yorkshire Television, etc. He does stuff for Al Jazeera, produces documentaries, but he's written a book. He's just published a book about the death of Robert Kennedy, and his name is Tim Tate. And I started by asking him about this guy, Sirhan Sirhan, who was supposedly responsible, and why it was that he keeps being refused parole, even though he's been on his best behaviour ever since the 1960s in prison in America.
He has repeatedly, that was the 15th occasion when he came up for parole. And there is a reason why he is denied parole, an ostensible reason. Sirhan has never been able to to recall the assassination. The last thing he recalls is having a cup of coffee with a girl in a polka dot dress, surprise, surprise, in the Ambassador Hotel before the shooting. The next thing he remembers is a large group of men jumping on his head and wrestling the gun from him. The period in between, he cannot remember. And cynics might say, well, he doesn't want to remember. Psychiatrists and psychologists, both from the prosecution and defense and independent and in prison, have worked on Sirhan and with Sirhan ever since. That amnesia is genuine. And more than that, what all of the independent and defense psychiatrists said, is it was the result of hypnoprogramming. However odd that sounds, it is scientific. There is a strong scientific basis for showing that Sirhan was acting under hypnosis on that night.
It's just like the Manchurian Candidate style thing. I mean, it was being worked on at the time, I believe, by the US, the CIA.
Yeah, people quite often roll their eyes at this point and say, oh, you're talking nonsense, or this is the stuff of conspiracy or science fiction. And I have to quietly say to them, I wish in many ways that were true. Unfortunately, the CIA's own documents, which anyone can access, I got them, they're available for $10 from the CIA now, show that from the 1950s through the early 1960s, it embarked on a program explicitly to create a hypno-programmed political assassin. Not my words, its own words. What's more, there are documents in that collection, and we reproduce all of these in the book, which show that it perfected that technique. It wasn't just an experiment which said, could we do this? It was an experiment which said, could we do this? Oh, and yes, we have. We've made it work.
That was Tim Tate there speaking about his new book on the Robert Kennedy assassination, the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Martin, another thing that Tim talks about, and you can hear that full interview next Tuesday at noon here on BCFM on our Dialect show, is that the sound recording which was being made at the time where Robert Kennedy was shot contained lots of shots, far more than could have been in Sirhan's gun. So clearly someone else was also doing the shooting.
Yeah, well, RF Kennedy's son is now questioning what happened here and questioning whether Sirhan was guilty. And of course, there's been a civil case in the US in which Martin Luther King's family convinced a jury that James Earl Ray didn't assassinate King, but he was killed by others. And of course, JFK himself was killed in 1964. The reason why we're talking about the RFK case today is partly the book, but of course it's 50 years since the assassination. I'm afraid the Secret Services of the United States of America are not very nice people. They never have been nice people, nor their Israeli or Mafia allies.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah, they're basically...
Who's behind this and what's their agenda?
Well, it's hard... The first point we need to establish is that the official story is simply not believable. Who actually did it is then open to discussion. That's what an investigation would uncover if one were allowed to happen. The suspicion is that we're talking about the same very powerful networks which have always been operating. They are financiers linked with intelligence services, Israeli intelligence services, and Western intelligence.
What about Lyndon Johnson?
Well, Johnson may have been informed. He may have been complicit. That's definitely not in this the case of RFK, because he'd left power by that stage, but certainly in the case of JFK. And you know, when people say, well, this is just conspiracy theory poo-poo, I just say, well, it's staring you in the face that this is what happened.
The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, Crime, Conspiracy and Cover-Up is the book, and I'll put a link to that on our show page. Well done, Tim. It's 30 years of digging around the files in the States. He's come up with a pretty good assessment of what happened. Now we're going to hear from Daniel Hopsicker, another investigative journalist, this time from the US. And he is somebody who worked very closely with someone called Gary Webb in uncovering the secret flights organised by Oliver North as part of the Iran-Contra scandal, that is, flights of drugs up from Colombia.
Hi, I'm Daniel Hopsicker. I got interested in arcane subject matter back in about 1998 with Gary Webb. And I had not been political at all in like 30, 35 years, but I realized Gary Webb was getting just extremely, extremely bad shape. He was right about everything he was saying about the CIA and drugs, and yet he was run out of journalism, and that sort of sparked outrage in me. So subsequent to that, I went down to Louisiana. Gary Webb talked about the West Coast drug trafficking line. There was another one through the Midwest that was probably even more important and certainly more well-connected, through Barry Seal. They called him a soldier of fortune. He was a lifetime CIA pilot. He had a fascinating career. At the age of 16, he was flying weapons with David Ferry to Cuba in support of Fidel Castro. This is back when the CIA supported Castro, and that was the first I had heard of that. I admit to you, I'm not like a total nerd on that sort of stuff. Then he went on and had an illustrious career as America's most famous drug trafficker. The government said he brought 50 tons of cocaine in the 80s into the United States, in large measure fueling, you know, the cocaine, the go-go 80s. That was the go-go 80s. If you remember, that was the go-go 80s. So the chances are, if you did cocaine during the 1980s in the United States of America, Barry Seal probably had something to do with it. And he wasn't transportation for the Medellin cartel. He basically, for the CIA, put together the Medellin cartel, I was told by numerous people. And he reported directly to George Herbert Walker Bush. And that's how he died. He threatened the then vice president with revealing the Contra cocaine scheme if then vice president Bush did not call off the IRS, which was in the middle of raiding his house and impounding his furniture in front of his wife and three kids. He had a deal, he thought, with the government, which involved pleading guilty to drug charges in Miami and then doing what's called in criminal circles, and I'll bet this is the case in England too, working off a beef, which meant going to work for the DEA, you know, until he had done enough for them so that they were willing to let him serve a minimal sentence, if anything at all, on what he was charged with, was basically major drug trafficking.
Now, this has been talked about. In fact, the whole thing has been recently released as a film with Tom Cruise called American Made, in fact, and that didn't actually get all that much of a push at the box office, but that whole story has been told, really, now.
That movie it had nothing to do with Barry Seal. I mean, if they'd called their American drug trafficker Tommy Two-Ton, it would have borne as much relationship to the life and death of Barry Seal as the movie did, which may or may not have been by accident. The guy that made the movie was a guy named Doug Lamone, well-known director. He's done some movies I've enjoyed, probably you have too, I don't know. But his dad was Arthur Lamone, who was the majority counsel on the Kerry Commission, which almost, but didn't quite, get to exposing the Contra cocaine. Are you with me? I mean, that's how deep these things go. Plus, it was the only movie the only American movie that's been made in Medellin, Colombia in like 45 years. So he had to ask what was up with that. And then two pilots died making the movie, and that was a tragedy and probably could have been avoided. The people that made that movie were interested in painting Barry Seal in front of a 15 to 20 year old audience as an American buccaneer, okay, as basically a good guy. And I don't know if they got that message across. I suspect they didn't. Tom Cruise was as unlikely a person to play Barry Seal as anyone you could imagine. John Goodman, American actor John Goodman, would have been a good Barry Seal, because that's what Barry Seal looked like. But Tom Cruise, I mean, it was a joke. And here's the thing, Tony. It was a joke about something that's important in recent American history. This guy Barry Seal, in 50 years, they'll be saying he was part of like some operation that went on in the 80s that did this, that, and the other, and he deserved better treatment. I mean, but this is the United States of America, and our History Channel specializes in ancient aliens. That's a true story. The History Channel in the U.S. Is wall-to-wall ancient aliens and kind of pawnbrokers and anything but history.
That's Daniel Hopsicker there. His website, madcowprod.com, speaking from the US. Now, Daniel's book, Martin, Barry and the Boys, really did help expose this, and was marvellous that someone picked up the baton after the death of Gary Webb, because they really did not want this information to get out to the public, did they?
No, there's another Hollywood film called Dark Alliance, which is about the life of Gary Webb. I think this stuff is actually... ought to be common knowledge. The CIA, massively involved in the drugs trade from the 1940s onwards in China, then in Vietnam with Air America and the Hmong, who were basically, and they've been involved in the drugs trade for years. They use it to fund their as a slush fund so that they don't have to account to any politician about what they do. And then, of course, they pretend that they serve us. It's
getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Finally, tonight we're going to have to skip the slave trade. We'll do that next week. We'll hear now from Alan Sabrosky. He's the former head of studies at the US Army War College. And he charts here the rise of the US-Israel lobby.
A very good friend of mine named Mick Traynor, otherwise Lieutenant General Bernard C. Traynor, United States Marine Corps, retired. He died a couple of years ago. And I were having a chat once in Washington back in the late 80s. And he made a comment to me. He was still on active duty at the time. He made a comment to me that sometimes you have to lie in order to buy time to deal with a problem. But you should never lie to yourself. And I took his maxim to heart. And so I'm going to take it to heart today. The topic is the impact of Zionism in the U.S. and, of course, by extension, in other Western countries. And the first thing I think that we need to understand is that the Zionists have won the battle for hearts and minds. They have won. The rest of us are sort of like fleas attacking a herd of elephants. We can make them stumble occasionally. We can do them damage. We look for bright sides. And that doesn't mean we should stop fighting, but we do look for bright sides, even when there aren't many bright sides out there, but they have won. And the evidence for that, both in absolute terms and relative to the position of Israel in the Middle East and the Zionist lobby in the United States, are overwhelming. By any measure you want to use, Israel is militarily stronger now than it was 10 years ago. It has American bases in Israel, providing additional defense for it. There are more settlements with more settlers. The Palestinians in East Jerusalem and the West Bank are marginalized, and those in Gaza are essentially in a concentration camp. They are not completely hopeless, and many of them don't seem to have given up, but their position is far worse than it was 10 years ago. Within the United States, their control of the U.S. government is close to absolute, as you can imagine. They control both houses of the Congress through the appointments process in the Senate. They have a dominant role in the executive branch. They have extended that influence down into state governments. I think it is now 21 or 22 have made it illegal to support the BDS movement, certainly to support boycotts and disinvestment. South Carolina has either just approved or is on the verge of approving a state law making criticism of Israel illegal. The extent of that influence is enormous. And I think probably nothing made that clearer or should have made it clearer to any of us, as when the U.S. Embassy was moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and the Israelis celebrated, if that's the right word, by killing about 60 Palestinians and wounding over 3,000 others. And the response of the White House, and I watched the press conference where the assistant press secretary made this announcement, that the response of the White House, that Israel bore no blame for this. It was totally the fault of Hamas, and, quote, Israel had a right to defend itself, end quote. How one talks about shooting unarmed children and an unarmed Palestinian nurse as self-defense is a little bit difficult for me to understand, but that is the extent of the White House. It is the same in many other countries. Their control in Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand is far greater than it was 10 years ago. The only difference is that in those countries, it is still possible to find an occasional parliamentarian who will stand up and criticize Israel. I don't believe any member of Congress, either party, criticized the White House for its blanket and unrestricted support of Israel on the day the embassy moved for the casualties it inflicted on the Palestinians. If that doesn't constitute winning, I don't know what does. They may have lost a soccer team, and they may have lost a little bit on the cultural side, and they're certainly embarrassed by BDS, but that doesn't weigh very heavily at all on the mechanics of power. And they have power. They have power in their own region, and they have influence here. The only thing that they haven't done yet is been able to get us to attack Iran or get support elsewhere to attack Iran, but they're trying. They're trying very hard. And I expect they're not giving up trying to do that. Having said that, what I propose to do, now that I've made everyone feel good, is to look at what has happened and why and where we go now from here. The growth of Zionist influence in the United States essentially went through three phases. The first phase was from 1948 through 1956. Those of us who are used to AIPAC and the laundry list of alphabet Jewish organizations out there exercising so much influence today sometimes forget that in the late 1940s, right after World War II, they didn't have that influence. Truman's recognition of Israel, against the advice of virtually everyone in the State Department, was based, in his own words, on a simple calculus of domestic politics. He had made a comment to someone, there are hundreds of thousands of Jewish votes in the United States, most of them now for Democrats. There are no Arab votes in the United States for anyone. This cost me nothing. And he did that. But the principal supporters of Israel from 1948 on, actually into the 1960s, were Britain and France. They provided most of the hardware for them, most of the aircraft, most of the tanks. And the United States really didn't do much at all except having provided that recognition. AIPAC came into existence in 1951. As a fairly trivial and virtually irrelevant entity. And that continued into 1956, when Israel, along with Britain and France, attacked Egypt, and Eisenhower, who had not a Holocaust memorial to his name, nor a Holocaust Memorial Day to his name, nor ever went to the Wailing Wall and reflected upon the inequities of life in Israel, ordered all three of them out, and they got. And here is where there's an interesting insight from the 1980s on 1956. In the 1980s, I taught a course in comparative foreign policy, among other things, at Georgetown University. And I would have speakers from different countries in to talk to the class and give their view of their country's position in the world. And as in many cases, what they didn't talk about was often as intriguing as what they did and the twist that they would put on it. After the class, since I couldn't offer them an honorarium, I would take the speaker from the foreign embassy and two of my students, one male and one female, out to dinner. And the students fought viciously for the chance to go to dinner. And at one of those occasions, the diplomat was from the Israeli embassy. He was a young fellow, late 20s, early 30s, immigrant to Israel from Romania, fluent English. And we went off to a nice Indian restaurant for dinner. And in the process of the conversation, one of the students asked him about the Israeli response to the U.S. position in 1956, because, you know, the student was coming from a period in the 1980s where he knew how influential Israel was, and he was just curious about that time. And this is what the Israeli diplomat told me. He said, in 1956, when Israel ordered us out, and he didn't mention or care about Britain and France, he said, us, Israel. When Eisenhower ordered us out, our diplomats went to Capitol Hill to see if we could get Congress to countermand that. And we had, and this is a direct quote, access to only two minor congressional offices. Two minor congressional offices in 1956. And we realized at that point that we had to do something very different. And I think 1956 should be seen as the starting point for the Israeli determination to do something different and not be put in that position again, the position they were in 1956. Asked one of my students, well, how many congressional offices do you have access to today? And this was 1987, 88. I don't remember precisely. And he leaned back and smiled and he said, almost all of them. Almost all of them. 30 years from two minor offices to almost all of them. And the students stared at him and he said, oh, of course, those members of Congress only act in the American interest. And the students looked at each other. They didn't believe him. And of course, I knew better. But that was the interesting point for the shift in their view. 1956 until the 1970s was the growth of Israeli influence within the U.S. government and the beginning of their influence in other parts of the society. The media, information, they already had Hollywood. A mark of the change in 1956 war and the 1967 war, the Israelis fought basically still with British and French equipment. The aircraft, for example, which attacked the USS Liberty on June 8th, 1967, were French-built Mirage and Mystère fighters. In 1973, it was American equipment. They still had some of the British and French equipment, but American equipment, A-4 Skyhawks, M-46 and M-48 tanks, those had come into being. That's the period of the growth of their influence. And from the 1970s until today, they've gone from influence to dominance. Why has this happened? Well, first of all, obviously, there is the organizations which the Israelis have used to further their interest and ambitions within the United States. There are analogs in Britain and Canada and Australia and New Zealand, but I'm not conversant with all of those, the details of that, so I'll leave that for someone else. People occasionally ask if there is a Jewish lobby. There is. And it's called the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations. It has its own website, Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations. The exact membership varies a bit. At this point, there are 50 formal organizations and three adjuncts. These organizations run from the Anti-Defamation League, which started in 1913, to AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which, as I mentioned, began in 1951 And the founder of it, by the way, was a former Israeli foreign ministry official, incorporated in 1963 and began its growth at that point. The Christians United for Israel, which came into existence in the early 1990s, basically was pretty irrelevant, and then got a shot in the arm and a boost in influence in about 2003, I believe, when John Hagee took it over. And it functions as the counterpart for AIPAC within basically evangelical Christians. Although it's interesting to note that as of this year, the director and the director of communications of this collection of televangelists and their partners are both Jewish and former AIPAC officials. And as part of their program, AIPAC, in addition to spawning Kufi later on, had gone through an extensive period in the 1960s and early 70s when it was building its influence of massaging a very large number of evangelical Protestant pastors, you know, with awards, all expense paid trips to Israel, things of this nature, all intended to make them think well of Israel. And the idea was that where the pastors led, their flocks would follow. And largely, that's been the case. And so the formal organizations working have made a significant impact to the extent that AIPAC, for all practical purposes, not only has a dominant role in both houses of the Congress, it drafts legislation, presents it to a friendly member, and I'm not sure there are any hostile members anymore. Even neutrality is frowned on, and that legislation will go forward. They got caught once on it. It was an AIPAC document that was actually put on the table of some legislation.
That's Alan Sobroski there, speaking on the Truth Jihad Radio about the rise of the Israel lobby in the US. Martin, to the point now where actually AIPAC drafts US legislation. They've done quite well, haven't they?
They have. They've done very well. And of course, people might not realize that Sobroski is one of the, he's an ex-military man from the US and of Jewish extraction, but he's a leading believer in the deep state's involvement in 9/11. And he thinks the Israelis were involved as well. He's a lieutenant colonel in the US Marines.
No, he wasn't a lieutenant colonel. No, he wasn't. Because I've been chatting to him about that. But anyway, the whole point here is that the US policy towards Israel is actually set by Israel, not by the US. Anyway, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 8 now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. That was Councillor for Westbury on Trim, Steve Smith. You'll find this show's comment page at thisweek.org.uk, and you'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.